This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. So many rooms are virtual rooms these days, and The Briefing Room is no different. It's a place where minds and expertise meet to deliver me, the presenter, and you, the listener, the best judgment available in 28 minutes on a big topic of the moment. This week, the inequalities of lockdown. How are different groups and places faring under this unique pressure? It's been the longest 3 weeks. Much of the economy has been shut down and daily lives transformed. No school, no meals out, no pub visits, no coffee shop chats, no cinema trips, no visiting granddad in the care home, no weddings. The list goes on. And we've been introduced to words and phrases that would have been alien just a little while ago. Self-isolation, social distancing, lockdown. It's difficult for everyone, but perhaps not in equal measure. That's what I want to find out this week. Is the pandemic exacerbating social inequalities in health, education, earnings, access to public space even? And if so, will they last when all this is over? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, health and a bit of history. Angus Deaton is Professor of Economics at Princeton University. He's one of the world's foremost chroniclers of poverty, inequality, health and well-being, and has won a Nobel Prize for his efforts. Professor Deaton, tell me about past pandemics. Aren't they essentially great levellers with pestilence coming for us all?
Well, there is that. I mean, the virus or the bacterium or whatever it is doesn't really care whether you're rich or whether you're poor, whether it's you or a commoner. So in that sense, they come for us all. You know, the plagues and the smallpox and all that sort of thing that swept through the country, they didn't seem to make much distinction in the end because, you know, from the 1300s on until the 1700s, there really was very little difference in life expectancy at birth between ducal families or even the kings and the ordinary people. There was a huge amount of fluctuation from year to year as these epidemics came and went, but there was no big upward trend in life expectancy of the sort that we got used to in the 19th and 20th century. But the question is, the next stage is when you can do something about them. And it's often the case that historically, when new things come along that are life-saving, they tend to come to the powerful and rich and wealthy first. So, you know, in England, Lady Mary Montagu, I think was her name, had been the wife of the British ambassador in Istanbul. And she saw people there doing the practice of variolation, which is a way of taking material from someone who's got smallpox and rubbing it into someone who hasn't. And it gives them a mild dose and protects them, occasionally kills them. And that practice had been going on in Africa and in China for maybe 1,000 years. She brought it to Britain in the middle of the 18th century, and the king started off by inoculating his whole family. And it spread down through the ranks. People who have more money and more power are better capable of doing something to protect themselves. Now we've got this new pandemic that comes along. I mean, you know, how could a pandemic that strikes your heir to the throne and your prime minister, you know, it sounds like it's a pretty equal opportunity pandemic. On the other hand, we do understand quite a lot about how to keep ourselves safe. And the thing about social distancing is it tends to be easier for those of us who are very well educated and well paid and all the rest of it than it is for people who are much less fortunate. You know, if you think of the essential workers, many of these essential workers are working with their hands. So they're putting themselves at risk in a way that those of us who are safely isolated in our mansions are really not.
Are you also more at risk if you're living in a, let's say, I mean, classically, we always talk about it here in Britain, in a tower block, side by side with lots of other families, than if you're living in a semi-detached house in the suburbs?
A tower block, you know, you ride up and down in the elevators, you're often very close to people. And, you know, even if you know that that's dangerous, it's not clear what you can do about it.
That's how it would be within, let's say, one developed country. When we come to look at it at a global level, what's the picture look like?
Well, that's a really interesting question, and it's one where there's a tremendous amount of debate going on right now. Because if you think of the lockdowns in India, the lockdowns in South Africa, and many Latin American and Caribbean countries are doing the same, the lockdowns are just impossible. If you live in a shanty town outside Cape Town, you know, no sort of social distancing is even conceivable. But they will deprive them of their livelihoods. And so for them, you get the worst of all worlds. One of the arguments in rich countries is that we want to preserve the health service so it's not overwhelmed. But in many really poor countries, there isn't much of a health service to overwhelm.
Angus Deaton. Next, education. Professor Simon Burgess from Bristol University researches the economics of education. He says that school closures are not having the same impact on all children.
It's going to be very different experiences for different children in different households. So I have no data on this, but I'm hearing stories from friends whose children go to private schools. And in terms of lessons, at least, it seems to be very close to business as usual. Their own teachers are teaching lessons to their own class, obviously online through various video links. Homework is being set and is being submitted. For those sorts of children, learning at home for a term is going to make not much difference to their educational outcomes. For other families, it's going to make a big difference. Going to school is important for everyone, but it does seem to make more of a difference for disadvantaged children. The children in more disadvantaged households are getting fewer educational inputs from home. So the school's going to make more of a difference. Some children may actually learn very little at all over the 12 weeks of the next term. You need somewhere quiet to sit and to learn, to think about what you've been reading online. You also need the tech, you need the equipment. Your household needs to have enough devices for you and your siblings to study online. So when you add those up, that starts to become quite a lot of devices that a household needs. And you need parents who understand what you're learning. For children who have very negative experiences of learning at home, they're going to lose skills to a non-trivial amount. It's hard to estimate, but we reckon maybe a GCSE grade overall, or something like an eighth of a grade over each of eight subjects. And that one eighth of a grade per subject might make all the difference. Exceptional times require exceptional measures. And so I think there's probably little alternative to using teacher assessments as the base for the marks for the exams that have been cancelled, so GCSEs and A-levels. But we know from a good deal of evidence that teacher assessments can be somewhat biased for or against different groups. Let me give you an illustration. For Key Stage 2 exams that children take when they're 11, in English, three times as many disadvantaged students do better than their teacher expected than those who do less well than their teacher expected. And in science, it's four times. So I hope that when these teacher assessments are used in place of exam scores, that that kind of information is taken into account. The Ofqual have announced we're going to ask exam boards to standardise these judgments across schools. And I hope that's the point where maybe they can take account of some of these well-known issues. A lot of us are trying to think about policies that could be put in place to try and ameliorate the effects of this lockdown. I guess we're thinking about some extra classes in the winter term. if those children are not going to have persistent effects from this term, that's the kind of thing we're going to need to do. More money, more teachers, and more time learning for the kids. That's going to be a big investment.
Professor Simon Burgess, what about the grown-ups? What's been happening to jobs and earnings during the lockdown? Xiaowei Zhu is a senior research economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. What do we know about numbers of people claiming universal credit?
We know that in the last 2 weeks of the lockdown, we've seen nearly a million universal credit claims. And that's even though the government's put in place a lot of support for businesses to tide them over the crisis. Lots of people are still losing their jobs. We're still seeing substantial falls in their income.
Why, given what the government's done, have so many people been sacked effectively rather than furloughed? What's the proportion between them?
So I'm afraid we don't know that yet because we're still waiting for data to come through. But I think there's a number of reasons businesses might still have to close down despite the generous support that the government's provided. So for one, there's a great deal of uncertainty over how long the crisis will last. And lots of businesses, especially small businesses, just won't have the cash reserves to tide themselves over.
Do we know which sectors have been worst hit when it comes to having to actually shed staff or close down?
Those sectors that have no productive work to do at the moment because of the lockdown, because they've been told to close down by the government, are those that are most likely to have to start shedding workers. So retail, hospitality, arts and leisure.
Now, let's go through what we mean by those. Retail, all kinds of shops.
All kinds of shops, with the exception of food shops, which of course are still running and seeing huge increases in demand. Hospitality would include things like hotels and restaurants, cafes, pubs. And arts and leisure would be anything from theatres to sporting facilities.
What do we know about who is predominantly employed in those sectors?
So we know that these sectors predominantly employ young people, and because they're not very high paid sectors, they predominantly employ low earners. So we found that nearly a third of employees below the age of 25 work in these sectors. So they're really hugely affected.
Sorry, let me get that straight. So if you're under 25,
exactly,
a third of you, a third of you employed in these sectors.
Precisely. It seems to be, for many people, the first rung in people's career ladders. And this is important because we know from previous evidence that periods of unemployment at the start of people's careers can have long-lasting effects on their future earnings and employment.
And what's the gender balance in these employments?
We find that women are slightly more likely than men to be in affected sectors, but the starkest difference is really by income. So the lowest earners, those in the bottom tenth of the earnings distribution, are seven times more likely to work in these shutdown sectors than those in the top 10th.
Now, how had these people been doing in terms of earnings in the period before the pandemic hit us?
We've had a decade of basically no earnings growth, right? So real earnings now are still around the same level as they were before the 2008 recession. So the current crash is really coming on top of what's already been a very long period of stagnation. And at the same time, we've also seen large cuts to benefits and tax credits over the last 10 years. So some earners would have seen their income squeezed as a result of that.
What do we know about the financial resources that people in this position are likely to have to hedge against a situation like this?
We know that many households wouldn't have enough savings to tide themselves over a few months without income. Lots of the people who are suffering from the lockdown don't have a lot in the way of other resources. For example, they don't have lots of other savings or high-earning partners who can tide them over, because otherwise they wouldn't qualify for universal credit.
Now, what can we say about the income distribution and characteristics of those people who are most able to work from home and carry on working?
So we know from data prior to the lockdown that those with high incomes were much more likely to be able to work from home. So people in professional jobs, for example. There's also a huge spending difference between a high income and low income households. So there's some new IFS research that shows that a quarter of household spending before coronavirus went to things that are now prohibited. So for example, eating out or travel or leisure activities, whereas lower income households spend most of their daily expenditure on essentials like groceries or rent. So I think it may well be that high-income households will emerge from the lockdown with more money to spend because they weren't able to spend it during the lockdown, whereas low-income households will then find it very difficult to adjust their spending if their income falls.
Well, there's a double whammy there, isn't there? Because what you're saying is the very things that the higher-income households are saving their money not spending on are the things that kept these lower-income families in jobs.
Exactly.
Those that have lost their jobs during the pandemic and the lockdown, what can we think about whether they are likely to get them back?
Part of it is around whether people are able to just go back to their previous jobs after the lockdown is over, or whether lots of businesses end up closing up. So new businesses will have to start and they'll have to rehire workers, and that would take a much longer time to adjust. The second issue, of course, is that at the moment, we've seen a big hit to sectors that have been shut down as a result of the government's health measures, but we don't yet know how much those effects are going to spill over into the rest of the economy. So the more that spreads across the rest of the economy, the harder it will be for people to return back to normal. I think the real question is how long it is before we go back to that prior state.
Xiaowei Zhu. So if some job sectors and some groups of workers are being disproportionately hit, can the same be said for different regions of the country? Paul Swinney is Director of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities. In a situation of a lockdown, one would imagine that job losses have been fairly equally spread across the country.
What we'd expect to see is that it will be fairly well spread across the country. And partly that's because if you think about the types of jobs that have been impacted, like retailers, restaurants, cafes, hairdressers, etc., they are spread across the country. And whether that's a greasy spoon in one part of the country or, say, the restaurant in the Ritz in London, all of those businesses have been hit fairly similarly.
Insofar as we can tell, where would we expect regionally or locally there to be the biggest impact?
If you think about sort of the exporters of a city, they're the ones that really generate the value. They're selling to national or international markets. And what we have to say is, well, how has that part of the economy been affected? Now, in some places, actually, it doesn't seem like it's going to be affected very much. But if you then, say, look at the aviation sector, so a place like Crawley, that's got Gatwick Airport, or the automotive sector, you know, we've seen a lot of factories being shut down. So we're thinking about, say, Vauxhall and Luton or Nissan in Sunderland. Then you start to see that there are some places that are coming out as being more affected than others from a jobs perspective. I think the second issue we've got to think about is, you know, what is the financial cushion that we see across the country that people can absorb, you know, this impact? And if we see people going from, you know, being paid 100% of their wages to 80% of wages through the job retention scheme, that fall of 20%, some people in certain parts of the country are going to be able to absorb that, I think, a little bit more easily than elsewhere. And I think here we do see much more of a north-south divide in terms of how small that financial cushion is in certain parts of the north.
Why would that be?
If we look at levels of debt across the country and we compare that to the amount of income, you know, if we look at a place like, say, Oxford, the amount of debt in the city is pretty low. Debt is about 10% of all income that comes in. In London, it's the same. In Edinburgh, it's about 12%. But if you were to, say, then look at a place like Blackpool or Sunderland, that figure jumps to 20%. And that's a bit of a challenge then. You know, if you then start to see that your income drops and you're just about making ends meet and you've got your rent to pay or your mortgages to pay as well, that then starts to bite much more severely than in a place where actually you've got some more savings built up, where you'd expect to see that more in places in the south.
We've heard that one of the groups of people that has gone through what the government has offered are groups of self-employed people. Does their problem have a kind of regional context?
London has more self-employed people than elsewhere, but it's spread throughout other places. However, if you look at the nature of self-employment, we do start to see quite clear patterns in that if you look at people who are using self-employment as a second source of income, so they've got their primary job where they're employed by somebody else, and then they've got this second job on the side. NHS consultants, for example, will work a certain number of days a week for the NHS and then will do some work privately. A much higher share of that situation occurs in cities in the Greater South East. Whereas if you start to look further north, the self-employed people that are there, much more likely to be relying on that source of income as being their primary source of income. So if the taps get turned off in terms of demand for that work, people sort of wanting to employ those people through self-employed contracts, that's a much bigger challenge again for people further north.
In terms of regions and areas, where is home working? Where's that likely to be most prevalent?
We do see a geographic pattern in terms of home working. The patterns that we see is reflective of sort of the strength of economies across the country, in that those sort of more knowledge-based service type jobs, as you would call them, law, finance, media to some extent, software development, etc. Those types of jobs in recent decades have clustered within the stronger cities in the south of England. And so what we see then as a knock-on impact of that is that the ability for people to keep the show on the road and continue to do that job at home is much more likely in cities in the south. So if we looked at a place like London, for example, we think 2 in 5 jobs could be done at home. Whereas if you compare that to, say, a place like Doncaster, we think it's about 1 in 5.
Really?
So that's quite a big sort of difference in terms of how is the economy able to take over in what we hope is a very short, sharp recession. We think that in London, that may well be a little bit easier to do than, say, in a place like Doncaster, where literally things have ground to a halt.
But are there any downsides to London and the South East from this amount of home working?
I think there's an irony to the fact that while working from home is something that can be more easily done in cities in the southeast of England in particular, because of the nature of work in this part of the country, the houses that you see in this part of the country are also smaller. You may have less access to green space as well because there's more flats, etc. And so if you are stuck at home, it's probably the case that it is nicer to be stuck at home in a city further north than what it is further south, because you've got more rooms to walk around. You've probably got much more easy access to a garden as well.
And also a significant number, even of professionals, young professionals, are in house and flat shares where they're very close up to each other.
Yes. And again, you'd expect to see that be much more of a problem in some of our places that have got the most expensive housing. And I think there's a concern there, of course, that you're living quite close to these people who aren't relatives, but you're relying on them to be sensible about how they're conducting their daily lives and going out and doing anything that they shouldn't be doing in terms of exposure to other people. That poses quite an interesting challenge that I think we hadn't really considered until this crisis came about.
Paul Swinney. The biggest question of all, perhaps, is will these inequalities persist once the lockdown finally lifts? Miatta Farnbulla is chief executive of the New Economics Foundation. The government is spending a lot already on its economic rescue package. Of course, we don't know when this is going to end, but presuming it ends within a matter of months, how big do you think UK debt will end up being?
We don't have a number yet, in part because it's not clear how much the government's job retention scheme, so that's a scheme it put in place to essentially subsidise 80% of wages, as well as its self-employment income protection scheme, how much these are going to cost, because it depends on who draws them down. But there was a pretty stark survey by the British Chamber of Commerce that showed that something like 50% of its members were planning to furlough about half of their staff over the course of the next week and a bit. And there was something like a third of its members that were looking to furlough somewhere between 75% and 100% of their staff. So, I mean, the scale of that is absolutely phenomenal. And the government's going to have to borrow in order to deal with that.
Do we have any idea of the order of magnitude?
Our expectations is that, you know, the government's deficit, so that's the amount it has to borrow over and above what it brings in terms of revenue, is likely to be somewhere around 200 billion by the end of this financial year. It's currently sitting at about 50 billion. There are so many unknowns in this scenario, but we wouldn't be surprised if we're talking about that order of magnitude. But I don't think they have any choice. It is absolutely the right thing to do.
Right. Now, this is a programme essentially about how the pandemic and the lockdown has had unequal consequences. If one of the things that we would decide to do was to try and reduce these inequalities as a consequence, presumably that would add significantly to the cost.
Yes, trying to address that will cost. But if it means that we come out of it with a stronger economy, a more fair and equal economy, one in which we are far more resilient to these sorts of shocks, then I think that's a cost that's worth paying the price for. You know, when times are tough, you realise just how foundational and important public services are. And in that I include Social Security, which is the safety net that we are all reliant on when we fall on hard times. How do we get these to a level that is adequate? And then how much do we all pay for it? And how do we do that in the most progressive way?
Are you essentially saying that we need to rethink, let's say, what proportion of our incomes we pay in taxes in order to fund those key services, not just the key services, actually, most services?
So absolutely. And I think there are three parts of this. I think the first is we tax income at a far higher level than we tax wealth. And increasingly, more people are better off because of wealth, the assets that they own, the homes that they own. But we're notoriously bad at taxing that. And so coming out of this, we have to think about a fairer balance between the taxation of income and the taxation of wealth. I think the second is that actually, what we did over the last 10 years, bizarrely, is of course we have to have a tax base that is fair to businesses because businesses are the engines of our economy. But, you know, you take something like corporation tax. Before the reductions in corporation tax that were put in place by George Osborne, our corporation tax was competitive versus other European countries. And yet we cut it. We cut it to one of the lowest levels. And then for me, the final piece is that in the end, I think as a society, we need to have an honest conversation that says, if we care about having services, like health, we've got to be willing to pay for it. And actually, I think the debate up to now has been relatively disingenuous, which is why I say we do have to have a conversation that says we all have to pay a little bit more. And I don't think we have had that debate. And I hope one of the things that comes out of it is to say, you know, when times are tough, you realize just how foundational and important these sorts of public services are.
And that's the central question, which is, someone has to pay, and for the most part, it's going to be most of us. That's the proposition you put forward. There's no easy solution.
Absolutely.
Miatta Farnbulla. But is it really likely that what so recently seemed far-fetched and ambitious will now become part of a new consensus? I put that to Professor Angus Deaton, who we heard from earlier. The phrase reset button has been used a lot recently. Now, historically, do events like this pandemic lead to any big re-evaluation of how we all live? Or is everybody just desperate usually to get back to where they were?
Neither one, I think. This idea that you can reset suggests a potency of government and of public will that I don't think really exists. But that's not to say that there won't be big changes that are driven by the long-term consequences of this thing. So I could talk about some of the things that I think will happen. One of them is, I think, the extreme globalization that we've seen, you know, building since the war and, you know, in the last 20 years, just quite extraordinary, with your motor car, you know, having different parts made in 100 different countries or something. I think that's really going to be enormously reduced. And I think that will help less well-paid workers in America and in rich countries, because, you know, the complaints that my job went to China, they closed the factory and took it to Mexico. Some of those factories are going to come back. Certainly not all of them, because a lot of the loss of jobs has been associated with technical change, with robots, if you like. And I see no reason to see that changing. But I think there will be a real slowdown in globalization. I mean, if you get in a mess like this and all your medicines are made halfway across the world and you can't get them anymore, that's going to be reassessed. That will narrow the distribution of income. It'll help working people
within a country, but not internationally.
It'll do the opposite internationally. So this miracle of globalization that has taken so many billions of people out of poverty in China and India will be much diminished. So they're going to lose as a result of this. And also, I think that there will be probably within poor countries, there'll be some diminution in inequality too, because a lot of the inequalities in poor countries are because a small minority has benefited from globalization and they will benefit less.
Professor Angus Deaton. So what conclusion can we draw from all this? Well, yes, it's pretty obvious that some people will emerge from this much worse than others. And that experience may alter some of our priorities. Ultimately, though, it'll be a political question what changes we're willing to attempt and how much we're willing to pay for them. My thanks to Simon Burgess, Xiaowo Zhu, Paul Swinney, Miatta Farnbulla and Angus Deaton. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Darren Graham and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by James Beard, and the editor was Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including removing the public sector pay cap, the workings of universal credit, and the cost of abandoning austerity. You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Paris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.